which, like stock options, contribute to the solution of the tax problems of executives. Tax-free foundations set up ostensibly for charitable and educational purposes, of which over 15,000 help to ease the tax burdens of their benefactors, though the charitable and educational activities of some of them are more or less invisible. And personal holding companies, which, subject to rather strict regulations, enable persons with very high incomes from personal services, like writing and acting, to reduce their taxes by what amounts to incorporating themselves. Of the whole array of loopholes in the code, however, probably the most widely loathed is the percentage depletion allowance on oil. As the word depletion is used in the code, it refers to the progressive exhaustion of irreplaceable natural resources. But as used on oil men's tax returns, it proves to mean a miraculously glorified form of what is ordinarily called depreciation. Whereas a manufacturer may claim depreciation on a piece of machinery as a tax deduction only until he has deducted the original cost of the machine, until, that is, the machine is theoretically worthless from where, an individual or corporate oil investor, for reasons that defy logical explanation, may go on claiming percentage depletion on a producing well indefinitely, even if this means that the original cost of the well has been recovered many times over. The oil depletion allowance is 27.5% a year, up to a maximum of half of the oil investor's net income. There are smaller allowances on other natural resources, such as 23% on uranium, 10% on coal, and 5% on oyster and clam shells. And the effect it has on the taxable income of an oil investor, especially when it is combined with the effects of other tax avoidance devices, is truly astonishing. For instance, over a recent 5-year period, one oil man had a net income of $14.33 million, on which he paid taxes of $80,000, or 0.6%. Unsurprisingly, the percentage depletion allowance is always under attack, but also unsurprisingly, it is defended with tigerish zeal. So tigerish that even President Kennedy's 1961 and 1963 proposals for tax revision, which taken together are generally considered the broadest program of tax reform ever put forward by a chief executive, did not venture to suggest its repeal. The usual argument is that the percentage depletion allowance is needed in order to compensate oilmen for the risks involved in speculative drilling, and thus ensure an adequate supply of oil for national use. But many people feel that this argument amounts to saying, the depletion allowance is a necessary and desirable federal subsidy to the oil industry, and thereby scuttles itself, since granting subsidies to individual industries is hardly the proper task of the income tax. The 1964 Revenue Act does practically nothing to plug the loopholes, but it does make them somewhat less useful, in that the drastic reduction of the basic rates on high incomes has probably led some high-bracket taxpayers simply to quit bothering with the less convenient or effective of the dodges. Insofar as the new bill reduces the disparity between the code's promises and its performance, that is, it represents a kind of adventitious reform. One way to cure all income tax evasion would be to repeal the income tax. However, quite apart from the sophistry, since 1964 happily somewhat lessened, that the code embodies, it has certain discernible and disturbing characteristics that have not been changed and may be particularly hard to change in the future. Some of them have to do with its methods of allowing and disallowing deductions for travel and entertainment expenses by persons who are in business for themselves, or by persons who are employed but are not reimbursed for their business expenses, deductions that were estimated fairly recently at between $5 and $10 billion a year, with the resulting reduction in federal revenue of between $1 and $2 billion. The travel and entertainment problem, or the T&E problem, as it is customarily called, has been around a long time, and has stubbornly resisted various attempts to solve it. One of the crucial points in T&E history occurred in 1930, when the courts ruled that the actor and songwriter George M. Cohan, and therefore anyone else, was entitled to deduct his business expenses on the basis of a reasonable estimate, even if he could not produce any proof of having paid that sum, or even produce a detailed accounting. The Cohan rule, as it came to be called, remained in effect for more than three decades, during which it was invoked every spring by thousands of businessmen as ritually as Muslims turned toward Mecca. Over those decades, estimated business deductions grew like kudzu vines as the estimators became bolder, with the result that the Cohan rule and other flexible parts of the T&E regulations were subjected to a series of attacks by would-be reformers. Bills that would have virtually or entirely eliminated the Cohan rule were introduced in Congress in 1951, and again in 1959, only to be defeated, in one case, after an outcry that T&E reform would mean the end of the Kentucky Derby. And in 1961, President Kennedy proposed legislation that not only would have swept aside the Cohan rule, but, by reducing to between $4 and $7 a day the amount that a man could deduct for food and beverages, would have all but put an end to the era of deductibility in American life. No such fundamental social change took place. Loud and long wails of anguish instantly arose from businessmen and also from hotels, restaurants, and nightclubs, and many of the Kennedy proposals were soon abandoned. Nevertheless, through a series of amendments to the code passed by Congress in 1962 and put into effect by a set of regulations issued by the Internal Revenue Service in 1963, they did lead to the abrogation of the Cohan rule and the stipulation that, generally speaking, all business deductions, no matter how small, would thenceforward have to be substantiated by records, if not by actual receipts. Yet even a cursory look at the law as it has stood since then shows that the new reformed T&E rules fall somewhat short of the ideal, that in fact they are shot through with absurdities and underlaid by a kind of Philistinism. For travel to be deductible, it must be undertaken primarily for business rather than for pleasure, and it must be away from home, that is to say, not merely commuting. The away-from-home stipulation raises the question of where home is and leads to the concept of a tax home, the place one must be away from in order to qualify for travel deductions. A businessman's tax home, no matter how many country houses, hunting lodges, and branch offices he may have, is the general area, not just a particular building, that is, of his principal place of employment. As a result, marriage partners who commute to work in two different cities have separate tax homes. But fortunately, the code continues to recognize their union to the extent of allowing them the tax advantages available to other married people. Although there have been tax marriages, the tax divorce still belongs to the future. As for entertainment, now that the writers of IRS regulations have been deprived of the far-reaching Cohan rule, they are forced to make distinctions of almost theological nicety. And the upshot of the distinctions is to put a direct premium on the habit, which some people have considered all too prevalent, for many years anyhow, of talking business at all hours of the day and night, and in all kinds of company. For example, deductions are granted for the entertainment of business associates at nightclubs, theaters, or concerts only if a substantial and bona fide business discussion takes place before, during, or after the entertainment. One is reluctant to picture the results if businessmen take to carrying on business discussions in great numbers during plays or concerts. On the other hand, a businessman who entertains another in a quiet business setting, such as a restaurant, with no floor show, may claim a deduction even if little or no business is actually discussed, as long as the meeting has a business purpose. Generally speaking, the noisier and more confusing or distracting the setting, the more business talk there must be. The regulations specifically include cocktail parties in the noisy and distracting category, and accordingly require conspicuous amounts of business discussion before, during, or after them. Though a meal served to a business associate at the host's home may be deductible with no such discussion at all. In the latter case, however, as the J.K. Lasser Tax Institute cautions in its popular guide, Your Income Tax, you must be ready to prove that your motive was commercial rather than social. In other words, to be on the safe side, talk business anyhow. Hellerstein has written, henceforth, tax men will doubtless urge their clients to talk business at every turn, and will ask them to admonish their wives not to object to shop talk if they want to continue their accustomed style of living. Entertainment on an elaborate scale is discouraged in the post-1963 rules, but as the Lasser booklet notes, perhaps a little jubilantly, Congress did not specifically put into law a provision barring lavish or extravagant entertainment. Instead, it decreed that a businessman may deduct depreciation and operating expenses on an entertainment facility, a yacht, a hunting lodge, a swimming pool, a bowling alley, or an airplane, for instance, provided he uses it more than half the time for business. In a booklet entitled Expense Accounts, 1963, which is one of many publications for the guidance of tax advisors that are issued periodically by Commerce Clearinghouse, Inc., the rule was explained by means of the following example. A yacht is maintained for the entertainment of customers. It is used 25% of the time for relaxation. Since the yacht is used 75% of the time for business purposes, it is used primarily for the furtherance of the taxpayer's business, and 75% of the maintenance expenses are deductible entertainment facility expenses. If the yacht had been used only 40% for business, no deduction would be allowed. The method by which the yachtsman is to measure business time and pleasure time is not prescribed. Presumably, time when the yacht is in dry dock or is in the water with only her crew aboard would count as neither, though it might be argued that the owner sometimes derives pleasure simply from watching her swing at anchor. The time to be apportioned, then, must be the time when he and some guests are aboard her, and perhaps his most efficient way of complying with the law would be to install two stopwatches, port and starboard, one to be kept running during business cruising and the other during pleasure cruising. Perhaps a favoring westerly might speed a social cruise home an hour early, or September blow delay the last leg of a business cruise, and thus tip the season's business time above the crucial 50% figure. Well might the skipper pray for such timely winds, since the deductibility of his yacht could easily double his after-tax income for the year. In short, the law's nonsense. Some experts feel that the change in T&E regulations represents a gain for our society because quite a few taxpayers who may have been inclined to fudge a bit under general provisions like the Cohan rule do not have the stomach or the heart to put down specific fraudulent items. But what has been gained in the way of compliance may have been lost in a certain debasement of our national life. Scarcely ever has any part of the tax law tended so energetically to compel the commercialization of social intercourse, or penalized so particularly the amateur spirit, which Richard Hofstadter declares in his book, Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, characterized the founders of the Republic. Perhaps the greatest danger of all is that, by claiming deductions for activities that are technically business but actually social, that is, by complying with the letter of the law, a man may cheapen his life in his own eyes. One might argue that the founders, if they were alive today, would scornfully decline to mingle the social and the commercial, the amateur and the professional, and would disdain to claim any but the most unmistakable expenses. But under the present tax laws, the question would be whether they could afford such a lordly overpayment of taxes, or should even be asked to make the choice. It has been maintained that the code discriminates against intellectual work, the principal evidence being that while depreciation may be claimed on all kinds of exhaustible physical property, and depletion may be claimed on natural resources, no such deductions are allowed in the case of exhaustion of the mental or imaginative capacities of creative artists and inventors, even though the effects of brain fag are sometimes all too apparent in the later work and incomes of such persons. It has also been argued that professional athletes are discriminated against in that the code does not allow for depreciation of their bodies. Organizations like the Authors League of America have contended further that the code is unfair to authors and other creative people whose income, because of the nature of their work and the economics of its marketing, is apt to fluctuate wildly from year to year, so that they are taxed exorbitantly in good years and are left with too little to tide them over bad years. A provision of the 1964 bill intended to take care of this situation provided creative artists, inventors, and other receivers of sudden large income with a 4-year averaging formula to ease the tax bite of a windfall year. But if the code is anti-intellectual, it is probably so only inadvertently, and is certainly so only inconsistently. By granting tax-exempt status to charitable foundations, it facilitates the award of millions of dollars a year, most of which would otherwise go into the government's coffers, to scholars for travel and living expenses while they carry out research projects of all kinds. And by making special provisions in respect to gifts of property that has appreciated in value, it has, whether advertently or inadvertently, tended not only to force up the prices that painters and sculptors receive for their work, but to channel thousands of works out of private collections and into public museums. The mechanics of this process are by now so well known that they need be merely outlined. A collector who donates a work of art to a museum may deduct on his income tax return the fair value of the work at the time of the donation, and need pay no capital gains tax on any increase in its value since the time he bought it. If the increase in value has been great, and the collector's tax bracket is very high, he may actually come out ahead on the deal. Besides burying some museums under such an avalanche of bounty that their staffs are kept busy digging themselves out, these provisions have tended to bring back into existence that lovable old figure from the pre-tax past, the rich dilettante. In recent years, some high-bracket people have fallen into the habit of making serial collections, post-impressionists for a few years, perhaps, followed by Chinese jade, and then by modern American painting. At the end of each period, the collector gives away his entire collection, and when the taxes he would otherwise have paid are calculated, the adventure is found to have cost him practically nothing. The low cost of high-income people's charitable contributions, whether in the form of works of art or simply in the form of money and other property, is one of the oddest fruits of the code. Of approximately $5 billion claimed annually as deductible contributions on personal income tax returns, by far the greater part is in the form of assets of one sort or another that have appreciated in value, and comes from persons with very high incomes. The reasons can be made clear by a simple example. A man with a top bracket of 20%, who gives away $1,000 in cash, incurs a net cost of $800. A man with a top bracket of 60%, who gives away the same sum in cash, incurs a net cost of $400. If instead, this same high bracket man gives $1,000 in the form of stock that he originally bought for $200, he incurs a net cost of only $200. It is the code's enthusiastic encouragement of large-scale charity that has led to most of the cases of million-dollar-a-year men who pay no tax at all. Under one of its most peculiar provisions, anyone whose income tax and contributions combined have amounted to 9/10 or more of his taxable income for 8 out of the 10 preceding years is entitled, by way of reward, to disregard in the current year the usual restrictions on the amount of deductible contributions, and can escape the tax entirely. Thus, the code's provisions often enable mere fiscal manipulation to masquerade as charity, substantiating a frequent charge that the code is morally muddle-headed, or worse. The provisions also give rise to muddle-headedness in others. The appeal made by large fundraising drives in recent years, for example, has been uneasily divided between a call to good works and an explanation of the tax advantages to the donor. An instructive example is a commendably thorough booklet entitled Greater Tax Savings, A Constructive Approach, which was used by Princeton in a large capital funds drive. Similar, not to say nearly identical booklets, have been used by Harvard, Yale, and many other institutions. The responsibilities of leadership are great, particularly in an age when statesmen, scientists, and economists must make decisions which will almost certainly affect mankind for generations to come. The pamphlet's foreword starts out loftily and goes on to explain, "The chief purpose of this booklet is to urge all prospective donors to give more serious thought to the manner in which they make their gifts. There are many different ways in which substantial gifts can be made at comparatively low cost to the donor. It is important that prospective donors acquaint themselves with these opportunities." The opportunities expounded in the subsequent pages include ways of saving on taxes through gifts of appreciated securities, industrial property, leases, royalties, jewelry, antiques, stock options, residences, life insurance, and inventory items, and through the use of trusts. The trust approach has great versatility. At one point, the suggestion is put forward that, instead of actually giving anything away, the owner of appreciated securities may wish to sell them to Princeton for cash at the price he originally paid for them. This might appear to the simple-minded to be a commercial transaction, but the booklet points out accurately that in the eyes of the code, the difference between the security's current market value and the lower price at which they are sold to Princeton represents pure charity and is fully deductible as such. While we have laid heavy emphasis on the importance of careful tax planning, the final paragraph goes, we hope no inference will be drawn that the thought and spirit of giving should in any way be subordinated to tax considerations. Indeed, it should not, nor need it be, with the heavy substance of giving so deftly minimized or actually removed, its spirit can surely fly, unrestrained. One of the most marked traits of the code, to bring this ransacking of its character to a close, is its complexity. And this complexity is responsible for some of its most far-reaching social effects. It is a virtual necessity for many taxpayers to seek professional help if they want to minimize their taxes legally. And since first-rate advice is expensive and in short supply, the rich are thereby given still another advantage over the poor. And the code becomes more undemocratic in its action than it is in its provisions. And the fact that fees for tax advice are themselves deductible means that tax advice is one more item on the long list of things that cost less and less to those who have more and more. All the free projects of taxpayer education and taxpayer assistance offered by the Internal Revenue Service, and they are extensive and well-meant, cannot begin to compete with the paid services of a good independent tax expert, if only because the IRS, whose first duty is to collect revenue, is involved in an obvious conflict of interest when it sets about explaining to people how to avoid taxes. The fact that about half of all the revenue derived from individual returns for 1960 came from adjusted gross incomes of $9,000 or less is not attributable entirely to provisions of the code. In part, it results from the fact that low-income taxpayers cannot afford to be shown how to pay less. The huge army of people who give tax advice, practitioners they are called in the trade, is a strange and disturbing side effect of the code's complexity. The exact size of this army is unknown, but there are a few guideposts. By a recent count, some 80,000 persons, most of them lawyers, accountants, and former IRS employees, held cards granted by the Treasury Department that officially entitled them to practice the trade of tax advisor and to appear as such before the IRS. In addition, there is an uncounted host of unlicensed and often unqualified persons who prepare tax returns for a fee, a service that anyone may legally perform. As for lawyers, the undisputed plutocrats, if not the undisputed aristocrats, of the tax advice industry, there is scarcely a lawyer in the country who is not concerned with taxes at one time or another during a year's practice. And every year there are more lawyers who are concerned with nothing else. The American Bar Association's taxation section, composed mostly of nothing but tax lawyers, has some 9,000 members. In the typical large New York law firm, one out of five lawyers devotes all of his time to tax matters, and the New York University Law School's tax department, an enormous broodhen for the hatching of tax lawyers, is larger than the whole of an average law school. The brains that go into tax avoidance, which are generally recognized as including some of the best legal brains extant, constitute a wasted national resource. It is widely contended, and this contention is cheerfully upheld by some leading tax lawyers, who seem only too glad to affirm, first, that their mental capacities are indeed exceptional, and second, that these capacities are indeed being squandered on trivia. The law has its cycles, one of them explained recently. In the United States, the big thing until about 1890 was property law. Then came a period when it was corporation law, and now its various specialties, of which the most important is taxes. I'm perfectly willing to admit that I'm engaged in work that has a limited social value. After all, what are we talking about when we talk about tax law? At best, only the question of what an individual or corporation should fairly pay in support of the government. All right, why do I do tax work? In the first place, it's a fascinating intellectual game, along with litigation, probably the most intellectually challenging branch of the law as it is now practiced. In the second place, although it's specialized in one sense, in another sense it isn't. It cuts through every field of law. One day, you may be working with a Hollywood producer, the next day with a big real estate man, the next with a corporation executive. In the third place, it's a highly lucrative field. Hypocritically egalitarian on the surface and systematically oligarchic underneath, unconscionably complicated, whimsically discriminatory, specious in its reasoning, pettifogging in its language, demoralizing to charity, an enemy of discourse, a promoter of shop talk, a squanderer of talent, a rock of support to the property owner but a weighty onus to the underpaid, an inconstant friend to the artist and scholar, if the national mirror image is all these things, it has its good points as well. Certainly, no conceivable income tax law could please everybody, and probably no equitable one could entirely please anybody. Louis Eisenstein notes in his book, The Ideologies of Taxation, "Taxes are a changing product of the earnest effort to have others pay them." With the exception of its more flagrant special interest provisions, the code seems to be a sincerely written document, at worst misguided, that is aimed at collecting unprecedented amounts of money from an unprecedentedly complex society in the fairest possible way, at encouraging the national economy, and at promoting worthy undertakings. When it is intelligently and conscientiously administered, as it has been of late, our national income tax law is quite possibly as equitable as any in the world. But, to enact an unsatisfactory law, and then try to compensate for its shortcomings by good administration is, clearly, an absurd procedure. One solution, that is more logical, to abolish the income tax, is proposed chiefly by some members of the radical right, who consider any income tax socialistic or communistic, and who would have the federal government simply stop spending money, though abolition is also advanced as theoretical ideal rather than as a practical possibility by certain economists who are looking around for alternative ways of raising at least a significant fraction of the sums now produced by the income tax. One such alternative is a value-added tax, under which manufacturers, wholesalers, and retailers would be taxed on the difference between the value of the goods they bought and that of the goods they sold. Among the advantages claimed for it are that it would spread the tax burden more evenly through the productive process than a business income tax does, and that it would enable the government to get its money sooner. Several countries, including France and Germany, have value-added taxes, though as supplements rather than alternatives to income taxes. But no federal tax of the sort is more than remotely in prospect in this country. Other suggested means of lightening the burden of the income tax are to increase the number of items subject to excise taxes and apply a uniform rate to them so as to create what would amount to a federal sales tax. To increase user taxes, such as tolls on federally owned bridges and recreation facilities, and to enact a law permitting federal lotteries, like the lotteries that were permitted from colonial times up to 1895, which helped finance such projects as the building of Harvard, the fighting of the Revolutionary War, and the building of many schools, bridges, canals, and roads. One obvious disadvantage of all these schemes is that they would collect revenue with relatively little regard to ability to pay, and for this reason, or others, none of them stand a chance of being enacted in the foreseeable future. A special favorite of theoreticians, but of hardly anyone else, is something called the expenditure tax, the taxing of individuals on the basis of their total annual expenditures rather than on their income. The proponents of this tax, diehard adherents of the economics of scarcity, argue that it would have the primary virtue of simplicity, that it would have the beneficial effect of encouraging savings, that it would be fairer than the income tax because it would tax what people took out of the economy rather than what they put into it, and that it would give the government a particularly handy control instrument with which to keep the national economy on an even keel. Its opponents contend that it wouldn't really be simple at all and would be ridiculously easy to evade, that it would cause the rich to become richer and doubtless stingier as well, and finally, that by putting a penalty on spending, it would promote depression. In any event, both sides concede that its enactment in the United States is not now politically practicable. An expenditure tax was seriously proposed for the United States by Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau, Jr. in 1942, and for Britain by a Cambridge economist, later a special advisor to the National Treasury, named Nicholas Caldor in 1951, though neither proponent asked for a repeal of the income tax. Both proposals were all but unanimously hooted down. "The expenditure tax is a beautiful thing to contemplate," one of its admirers said recently. "It would avoid almost all the pitfalls of the income tax, but it's a dream." And so it is in the Western world. Such a tax has been put in effect only in India and Ceylon. With no feasible substitute in sight, then, the income tax seems to be here to stay, and any hope for better taxation seems to lie in its reform. Since one of the code's chief flaws is its complexity, reform might well start with that. Efforts at simplification have been made with regularity since 1943, when Secretary Morgenthau set up a committee to study the subject, and there have been occasional small successes, simplified instructions, for example, and a shortened form for taxpayers who wish to itemize deductions, but whose affairs are relatively uncomplicated, were both introduced during the Kennedy administration. Obviously, though, these were more guerrilla skirmish victories. One obstacle to any victory more sweeping is the fact that many of the code's complexities were introduced in no interest other than that of fairness to all, and apparently cannot be removed without sacrificing fairness. The evolution of the special family support provisions provides a striking example of how the quest for equity sometimes leads straight to complexity. Up to 1948, the fact that some states had and some didn't have community property laws resulted in an advantage to married couples in the community property states. Those couples, and those couples only, were allowed to be taxed as if their total income were divided equally between them, even though one spouse might actually have a high income and the other none at all. To correct this clear-cut inequity, the federal code was modified to extend the income-dividing privilege to all married persons. Even apart from the resulting discrimination against single persons without dependents, which remains enshrined and unchallenged in the code today, this correction of one inequity led to the creation of another, the correction of which led to still another. Before the Chinese box sequence was played out, account had been taken of the legitimate special problems of persons who had family responsibilities, although they were not married, then of working wives with expenses for child care during business hours, and then of widows and widowers, and each change made the code more complex. The loopholes are another matter. In their case, complexity serves not equity, but its opposite, and their persistent survival constitutes a puzzling paradox. In a system under which the majority presumably makes the laws, tax provisions that blatantly favor tiny minorities over everybody else would seem to represent the civil rights principle run wild, a kind of anti-discrimination program for the protection of millionaires. The process by which new tax legislation comes into being, an original proposal from the Treasury Department or some other source, passage in turn by the House Ways and Means Committee, the whole House, the Senate Finance Committee, and the whole Senate, followed by the working out of a House-Senate compromise by a conference committee, followed by repassage by the House and the Senate, and finally followed by signing by the President, is indeed a torturous one, at any stage of which a bill may be killed or shelved. However, though the public has plenty of opportunity to protest special interest provisions, what public pressure there is apt to be greater in favor of them than against them. In the book on tax loopholes called The Great Treasury Raid, Philip M. Stern points out several forces that seem to him to work against the enactment of tax reform measures, among them the skill, power, and organization of the anti-reform lobbies, the diffuseness and political impotence of the pro-reform forces within the government, and the indifference of the general public, which expresses practically no enthusiasm for tax reform through letters to congressmen or by any other means, perhaps in large part because it is stunned into incomprehension and consequent silence by the mind-boggling technicality of the whole subject. In this sense, the code's complexity is its impenetrable elephant hide. Thus, the Treasury Department, which, as the agency charged with collecting federal revenues, has a natural interest in tax reform, is often left, along with a handful of reform-minded legislators, like Senators Paul H. Douglas of Illinois, Albert Gore of Tennessee, and Eugene J. McCarthy of Minnesota, on a lonely and indefensible salient. Optimists believe that some point of crisis will eventually cause specially favored groups to look beyond their selfish interests and the rest of the country to overcome its passivity, to such an extent that the income tax will come to give back a more flattering picture of the country than it does now. When this will happen, if ever, they do not specify. But the general shape of the picture hoped for by some of those who care most about it is known. The ideal income tax envisioned for the far future by many reformers would be characterized by a short and simple code, with comparatively low rates, and with a minimum of exceptions to them. In its main structural features, this ideal tax would bear a marked resemblance to the 1913 income tax, the first ever to be put in effect in the United States in peacetime. So, if the unattainable visions of today should eventually materialize, the income tax would be just about back where it started. Chapter 4. A Reasonable Amount of Time. Private information, whether of distant public events, impending business developments, or even the health of political figures, has always been a valuable commodity to traders in securities. So valuable that some commentators have suggested that stock exchanges are markets for such information just as much as for stocks. The money value that a market puts on information is often precisely measurable in terms of the change in stock prices that it brings about. And the information is almost as readily convertible into money as any other commodity. Indeed, to the extent that it is used for barter between traders, it is a kind of money. Moreover, until quite recently, the propriety of the use of inside dope for their own enrichment by those fortunate enough to possess it went largely unquestioned. Nathan Rothschild's judicious use of advance news of Wellington's victory at Waterloo was the chief basis of the Rothschild fortune in England, and no royal commission or enraged public rose to protest. Similarly, and almost simultaneously, on this side of the Atlantic, John Jacob Astor made an unchallenged bundle on advance news of the Ghent Treaty ending the War of 1812. In the post-Civil War era in the United States, the members of the investing public, such as it was, still docilely accepted the right of the insider to trade on his privileged knowledge, and were content to pick up any crumbs that he might drop along the way. Daniel Drew, a vintage insider, cruelly denied them even this consolation by dropping poison crumbs in the form of misleading memoranda as to his investment plans, which he would elaborately strew in public places. Most 19th-century American fortunes were enlarged by, if they were not actually founded on, the practice of insider trading. And just how different our present social and economic order would be if such trading had been effectively forbidden in those days provides a subject for fascinating, if bootless, speculation. Not until 1910 did anyone publicly question the morality of corporate officers, directors, and employees trading in the shares of their own companies. Not until the 1920s did it come to be widely thought of as outrageous that such persons should be permitted to play the market game with what amounts to a stacked deck. And not until 1934 did Congress pass legislation intended to restore equity. The legislation, the Securities Exchange Act, requires corporate insiders to forfeit to their corporations any profits they may realize on short-term trades in their own firm stock, and provides further, in a section that was implemented in 1942 by a rule designated as 10b-5, that no stock trader may use any scheme to defraud or make any untrue statement of a material fact or omit to state a material fact. Since omitting to state material facts is the essence of using inside information, the law, while it does not forbid insiders to buy their own stock, nor to keep the profits provided they hold on to the stock more than 6 months, would seem to outlaw the stacked deck. In practice, though, until very recently, the 1942 rule was treated almost as if it didn't exist. It was invoked by the Securities and Exchange Commission, the federal enforcement body set up under the Securities Exchange Act, only rarely, and in cases so flagrant as to be probably prosecutable even without it, under common law. And there were apparent reasons for this laxity. For one thing, it has been widely argued that the privilege of cashing in on their corporate secrets is a necessary incentive to business executives to goad them to their best efforts, and it is coolly contended by a few authorities that the uninhibited presence of insiders in the market however offensive to the spirit of fair play, is essential to a smooth, orderly flow of trading. Moreover, it is contended that the majority of all stock traders, whether or not they are technically insiders, possess and conceal inside information of one sort or another, or at least hope and believe that they do, and that therefore an even-handed application of Rule 10b-5 would result in nothing less than chaos on Wall Street. So in letting the rule rest largely untroubled in the rule book for 20 years, the SEC seemed to be consciously refraining from hitting Wall Street in one of its most vulnerable spots. But then, after a couple of preliminary jabs, it went for the spot with a vengeance. The lawsuit in which it did so was a civil complaint against the Texas Gulf Sulphur Company and 13 men who were directors or employees of that company. It was tried without a jury in the United States District Court in Foley Square on May 9th through June 21st, 1966, and as the presiding judge, Dudley J. Bonsall, remarked mildly at one point during the trial, "I guess we all agree that we are plowing new ground here to some extent." Plowing and perhaps sowing, too. Henry G. Mann, in a recent book entitled Insider Trading and the Stock Market, says that the case presents, in almost classic terms, the whole problem of insider trading, and expresses the opinion that its resolution may determine the law in this field for many years to come. The events that led to the SEC's action began in March 1959, when Texas Gulf, a New York City-based company that was the world's leading producer of sulfur, began conducting aerial geophysical surveys over the Canadian Shield, a vast, barren, forbidding area of eastern Canada that in the distant but not forgotten past had proved to be a fertile source of gold. What the Texas Gulf airmen were looking for was neither sulfur nor gold. Rather, it was sulfides, deposits of sulfur occurring in chemical combination with other useful minerals such as zinc and copper. What they had in mind was discovering mineable veins of such minerals so that Texas Gulf could diversify its activities and be less dependent upon sulfur, the market price of which had been slipping. From time to time, during the 2 years that the surveys went on intermittently, the geophysical instruments in the scanning planes would behave strangely, their needles jiggling in such a way as to indicate the presence of electrically conductive material in the earth. The areas where such things happened, called anomalies by geophysicists, were duly logged and mapped by the surveyors. All told, several thousand anomalies were found. It's a long way from an anomaly to a workable mine, as must be evident to anyone who knows that while most sulfides are electrically conductive, so are many other things, including graphite, the worthless pyrites called fool's gold, and even water. Nevertheless, several hundred of the anomalies that the Texas Gulf men had found were considered to be worthy of ground investigation. And among the most promising looking of all was one situated at a place designated on their maps as the Kid 55 segment. 1 square mile of muskeg marsh, lightly wooded and almost devoid of outcropping rocks, about 15 miles north of Timmins, Ontario, an old gold mining town that is itself some 350 miles northwest of Toronto. Since Kid 55 was privately owned, the company's first problem was to get title to it, or to enough of it to make possible exploratory ground operations. For a large company to acquire land in an area where it is known to be engaged in mining exploration obviously involves delicacy in the extreme, and it was not until June 1963 that Texas Gulf was able to get an option permitting it to drill on the northeast quarter section of Kid 55. On October 29th and 30th of that year, a Texas Gulf engineer, Richard H. Clayton, conducted a ground electromagnetic survey of the northeast quarter and was satisfied with what he found. A drill rig was moved to the site, and on November 8th, the first test drill hole was begun. There followed a thrilling, if uncomfortable, several days at Kid 55. The man in charge of the drilling crew was a young Texas Gulf geologist named Kenneth Dark, a cigar smoker with a rakish gleam in his eye, who looked a good deal more like the traditional notion of a mining prospector than that of the organization man he was. For 3 days the drilling went on, bringing out of the earth a cylindrical core of material 1¼ inches in diameter, which served as the first actual sample of what the rock under Kid 55 contained. As the core came up, Dark studied it critically, inch by inch and foot by foot, using no instruments but only his eyes and his knowledge of what various mineral deposits look like in their natural state. On the evening of Sunday, November 10th, by which time the drill was down 150 feet, Dark telephoned his immediate superior, Walter Hollick, Texas Gulf's chief geologist at his home in Stamford, Connecticut, to report on his findings so far. He made the call from Timmins, since there was no telephone at the Kid 55 drill site. Dark, Hollick has since said, was excited, and so apparently was Hollick after he had heard what Dark had to say, because he immediately set in motion quite a corporate flap for a Sunday night. That same evening, Hollick called his superior, Richard D. Mollison, a Texas Gulf vice president who lived near Hollick in Greenwich, and, still the same evening, Mollison called his boss, Charles F. Fogarty, executive vice president and the company's #2 man in nearby Rye, to pass Dark's report on up the line. Further reports were made the next day through the same labyrinth of command, Dark to Hollick to Mollison to Fogarty. As a result of them, Hollick, Mollison, and Fogarty all decided to go to Kid 55 to see for themselves. Hollick got there first. He arrived at Timmins on November 12th, checked in at the Bonaire Motel, and got out to Kid 55 by Jeep and Muskeg tractor in time to see the completion of the drill hole and to help Dark visually estimate and log the core. By this time, the weather, which had hitherto been passable for Timmins in mid-November, had turned nasty. In fact, it was quite inclement. Hollick, a Canadian in his 40s, with a doctorate in geology from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, has since said. It was cold, windy, threatening snow and rain, and we were much more concerned with personal comfort than we were with the details of the core hole. Ken Dark was writing, and I was looking at the core, trying to make estimates of the mineral content. To add to the difficulty of working outdoors under such conditions, some of the core had come out of the ground covered with dirt and grease, and had to be washed with gasoline before its contents could even be guessed at. Despite all difficulties, Hollick succeeded in making an appraisal of the core that was, to say the least, startling. Over the 600 or so feet of its final length, he estimated, there appeared to be an average copper content of 1.15% and an average zinc content of 8.64%. A Canadian stockbroker with special knowledge of the mining industry was to say later that a drill core of such length and such mineral content is just beyond your wildest imagination. Texas Gulf didn't have a surefire mine yet. There was always the possibility that the mineral vein was a long, thin one, too limited to be commercially exploitable, and that by fantastic chance, the drill had happened to go down dip, that is, straight into the vein like a sword into a sheath. What was needed was a pattern of several drill holes, beginning at different spots on the surface and entering the earth at different angles to establish the shape and limits of the deposit. And such a pattern could not be made until Texas Gulf had title to the other 3/4 segments of Kid 55. Getting title would take time, if it were possible at all. But meanwhile, there were several steps that the company could and did take. The drill rig was moved away from the site of the test hole. Cut saplings were stuck in the ground around the hole to restore the appearance of the place to a semblance of its natural state. A second test hole was drilled, as ostentatiously as possible, some distance away, at a place where a barren core was expected and found. all of these camouflage measures, which were in conformity with long-established practice among miners who suspect that they have made a strike, were supplemented by an order from Texas Gulf's president, Claude O. Stevens, that no one outside the actual exploration group, even within the company, should be told what had been found. Late in November, the Corps was shipped off, in sections, to the Union Assay Office in Salt Lake City for scientific analysis of its contents. And meanwhile, of course, Texas Gulf began discreetly putting out feelers for the purchase of the rest of Kid 55. And meanwhile, other measures, which may or may not have been related to the events north of Timmins, were being taken. On November 12th, Fogarty bought 300 shares of Texas Gulf stock. On the 15th, he added 700 more shares. On November 19th, 500 more. And on November 26th, 200 more. Clayton bought 200 on the 15th. Mollison, 100 on the same day. And Mrs. Hollick bought 50 on the 29th. And 100 more on December 10th. But these purchases, as things turned out, were only the harbingers of a period of apparently intense affection for Texas Gulf stock among certain of its officers and employees, and even some of their friends. In mid-December, the report on the Corps came back from Salt Lake City, and it showed that Hollick's rough-and-ready estimate had been amazingly accurate. The copper and zinc contents were found to be almost exactly what he had said, and there were 3.94 ounces of silver per ton thrown in as a sort of bonus. Late in December, Dark made a trip to Washington, D.C. and vicinity, where he recommended Texas Gulf stock to a girl he knew there and her mother. These two, who came to be designated in the trial as the tippies, subsequently passed along the recommendation to two other persons who, logically enough, thereby became the sub-tippies. Between December 30th and the following February 17th, Dark's tippies and sub-tippies purchased all told 2,100 shares of Texas Gulf stock. And in addition, they purchased what are known in the brokerage trade as calls on 1,500 additional shares. A call is an option to buy a stated amount of a certain stock at a fixed price, generally near the current market price, at any time during a stated period. Calls on most listed stocks are always on sale by dealers who specialize in them. The purchaser pays a generally rather moderate sum for his option. If the stock then goes up during the stated period, the rise can easily be converted into almost pure profit for him. While if the stock stays put or goes down, he simply tears up his call the way a horse player tears up a losing ticket and loses nothing but the cost of the call. Therefore, calls provide the cheapest possible way of gambling on the stock market and the most convenient way of converting inside information into cash. Back in Timmins, Dark, put temporarily out of business as a geologist by the winter freeze and the land ownership problem at Kid 55, seems to have managed to keep time from hanging heavy on his hands. In January, he entered into a private partnership with another Timmins man who wasn't a Texas Gulf employee to stake and claim Crown lands around Timmins for their own benefit. In February, he told Hollick of a barroom conversation that had occurred in Timmins one gelid winter evening, in which an acquaintance of his had let fall that he'd heard rumors of a Texas Gulf strike nearby, and was therefore going to stake a few claims of his own. Horrified, Hollick, as he recalled later, told Dark to reverse the previous policy of avoiding Kid 55 like the plague, and to go right into the area and stake all the claims we need. Also to steer away this acquaintance, give him a helicopter ride or anything, just get him out of the way. Dark presumably complied with this order. Moreover, during the first 3 months of 1964, he bought 300 shares of Texas Gulf outright, bought calls on 3,000 more shares, and added several more persons, one of them his brother, to his growing list of tippies. Hollick and Clayton were somewhat less financially active during the same period, but they did add substantially to their Texas Gulf holdings. In the case of Hollick and his wife, particularly through the use of calls, which they'd scarcely even heard of before, but which were getting to be quite the rage in Texas Gulf circles. Signs of spring began to come at last, and with them came a triumphant conclusion to the company's land acquisition program. By March 27th, Texas Gulf had pretty much what it needed. That is, it had either clear title or mineral rights to the three remaining segments of Kid 55, except for 10% profit concessions on two of the segments, the stubborn owner of the concession in one case being the Curtis Publishing Company. After a final burst of purchases by Dark, his tippies and his sub-tippies on March 30th and 31st, among them all 600 shares in calls on 5,100 more shares for the 2 days, drilling was resumed in the still-frozen muskeg at Kid 55, with Halleck and Dark both on the site this time. The new hole, the third in all, but only the second operational one, since one of the two drilled in November had been the dummy intended to create a diversion, was begun at a point some distance from the first, and at an oblique angle to it, to advance the bracketing process. Observing and logging the core as it came out of the ground, Halleck found that he could scarcely hold a pencil because of the cold, but he must have been warmed inwardly by the fact that promising mineralization began to appear after the first 100 feet. He made his first progress report to Fogarty by telephone on April 1st. Now a grueling daily routine was adopted at Timmins and Kid 55. The actual drilling crew stayed at the site continuously, while the geologists, in order to keep their superiors in New York posted, had to make frequent trips to telephones in Timmins. And what with the 7-foot snowdrifts along the way, the 15-mile trek between the town and the drilling camp customarily took 3.5 to 4 hours. One after another, new drill holes, begun at different places around the anomaly and pitched at different angles to it, were plunged into the earth. At first, only one drill rig could be used at a time because of a shortage of water, which was necessary to the operation. The ground was frozen solid and covered by deep snow, and water had to be laboriously pumped from under the ice on a pond about 0.5 mile from Kid 55. The third hole was finished on April 7th, and a fourth immediately begun with the same rig. The following day, the water shortage having eased somewhat, a fifth hole was inaugurated with a second drill rig, and 2 days after that, on the 10th, a third rig was pressed into service to drill still another hole. All in all, during the first days of April, the principals in the affair were kept busy. In fact, during that period, their buying of calls on Texas Gulf seems to have come to a standstill. Bit by bit, the drilling revealed the lineaments of a huge ore deposit. The third hole established that the original one had not gone down dip, as had been feared. The fourth established that the mineral vein was a satisfactorily deep one, and so on. At some point, the exact point was to become a matter of dispute, Texas Gulf came to know that it had a workable mine of considerable proportions, and as this point approached, the focus of attention shifted from drillers and geologists to staff men and financiers, who were to be the principal object of the SEC's disapproval later on. At Timmins, snow fell so heavily on April 8th and most of the 9th that not even the geologists could get from the town to Kid 55. But toward evening on the 9th, when they finally made it after a hair-raising journey of 7.5 hours, with them was no lesser light than Vice President Mollison, who had turned up in Timmins the previous day. Mollison spent the night at the drill site and left at about noon the next day, in order, he explained later, to avoid the outdoorsman's lunch they served at Kid 55, which was too hearty for a desk-bound man like him. But before going, he issued instructions for the drilling of a mill test hole, which would produce a relatively large core that could be used to determine the amenability of the mineral material to routine mill processing. Normally, a mill test hole is not drilled until a workable mine is believed to exist, and so it may have been in this case. Two SEC mining experts were to insist later, against contrary opinions of experts for the defense, that by the time Mollison gave his order, Texas Gulf had information on the basis of which it could have calculated that the ore reserves at Kid 55 had a gross assay value of at least $200 million. The famous Canadian mining grapevine was humming by now, and in retrospect, the wonder is that it had been relatively quiet for so long. A Toronto broker was to remark during the trial, "I have seen drillers drop the goddamn drill and beat it for a brokerage office as fast as they can, or else they pick up the telephone and call Toronto." After such a call, the broker went on, "The status of every Bay Street penny stock tout depends, for a time, on how close a personal acquaintance he can claim with the driller who made the strike, just as a racetrack tout status depends sometimes on the degree of intimacy he can claim with a jockey or a horse." The Moccasin Telegraph has Texas Gulf's activity centered in Kidd Township. "A battery of drills are reported to be at work," said the Northern Miner, a Toronto weekly of immense influence in the mining stock set on the 9th. And the same day, the Toronto Daily Star declared that Timmins was bug-eyed with excitement, and that the magic word on every street corner and in every barber shop is Texas Gulf. The phones in Texas Gulf's New York headquarters were buzzing with frenzied queries, which the officers coldly turned aside. On the 10th, President Stevens was concerned enough about the rumors to seek counsel from one of his most trusted associates, Thomas S. Lamont, senior member of the Texas Gulf Board of Directors, former second-generation Morgan partner, holder of various lofty offices, past and present, in the Morgan Guarantee Trust Company, and bearer of a name that had long been one to conjure with in Wall Street. Stevens told Lamont what had been going on north of Timmins. It was the first Lamont had heard of it, made it clear that he himself did not yet feel that the evidence justified bug eyes, and asked what Lamont thought ought to be done about the exaggerated reports. "As long as they stayed in the Canadian press," Lamont replied, "I think you might be able to live with them. However," he added, "if they should get into the papers in the United States, it might be well to give the press an announcement that would set the record straight and avoid undue gyrations in the stock market."